This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. This is lecture 11, given in Dornach on March 31st, 1920. Yesterday we ended up at a very different point from where we started, and today, too, our starting point will be very specific, concrete, and material. But we will then attempt to elaborate on the whole issue. We need to approach our task in concentric circles, as it were, partly because of the very nature of the questions, and partly because of the short time allotted to us. We cannot take the scientific route of beginning with axioms and moving on to ever more complicated concerns. My task today will be to show you the next concentric circles in the way we are looking at things. Our starting point will be Carbo vegetabilis. Yesterday we looked at Chicorium intubus, woodland strawberry, and the like, and today we will study a material that, although commonly available, is one of the world's most remarkable substances. This is the best way to see that, if we are seriously committed to observing nature, we are compelled to look further than modern science tends to look. It was very interesting to hear Dr. Kalisko point out in last night's lecture that in the future chemistry will actually have to become a completely different science. Footnote: Eugen Kalisko, 1893 to 1939, was a teacher and school physician at the Stuttgart Independent Waldorf School beginning in 1920, and later became active in England. End of footnote. The word physiology came up repeatedly, indicating that the gap between chemistry and physiology must be bridged. This made me think of many different points that still cannot be fully articulated in public lectures at present, because the prerequisites for understanding them are totally lacking. Certainly, we find carbon in non-human nature, or in what appears to be non-human nature, as I would prefer to put it. Actually, what aspects of nature truly are external to the human being? None of them, because everything we now encounter as external was removed from humankind and relocated outside in the course of human evolution. Humankind had to pass through evolutionary stages that were possible only because certain processes began to take place externally as opposed to internally, enabling human beings to internalize certain other processes. In this sense, both a contrast and a relationship always exist between certain outer and inner processes. Now, I must say I found a remarkable concordance between what was said yesterday about the need to physiologize chemistry. This may not express it very precisely, but you will know what I mean, especially if you heard Dr. Kalisko's lecture, and what Dr. Scheidegger was so kind as to set forth on Sunday in his very interesting presentation, indicating the need to understand the purpose of potentization from a spiritual scientific perspective. Footnote: Dr. Scheidegger, see note on page 139, lecture 9, end of footnote. At one point, we heard a remarkable statement, one that has concerned me for decades. It is often said that homeopathic physicians, too, are somewhat afraid of becoming mystical, of acquiring a reputation for mysticism. The reason for my involvement with this question is in very specific views that are absolutely based on realities. Please do not misunderstand what I am going to say here. It is necessary to speak just a bit radically in order to describe matters effectively. You see, in reality, the essence of what we are attempting in the homeopathic therapeutic process lies more in what we do to prepare the substances than in the substances themselves. How we prepare what we encounter in the form of salicylic acid or carbo vegetabilis, for instance, is the crucial point. I have studied at length what happens in the effort to prepare homeopathic remedies, which in this case certainly include the Ritter remedies, as Dr. Rascher confirms, although Miss Ritter herself does not admit this. Footnote: Hans Rascher, 1880-1952, physician in Munich. Regarding Marie Ritter, see the note on page 52, lecture 4, end of footnote. This raises the question of what actually happens when homeopathic remedies are produced. Everything depends on their preparation, on the entire production process. What are you doing when you produce a high potency of salicylic acid? You are working toward a certain point. Everything in nature is based on rhythmic processes. As you proceed along this course, working toward a certain null point, the inherent, immediately apparent effects of the substance in question come to light first. It is as if I have wealth and proceed to spend it. When I reach the null point and continue spending, what I then have is not merely no wealth at all. It goes beyond the point of being wealth and assumes the quality of debt. It is the same when I confront the material qualities of outer substances. If I remain within the effects of these substances, so to speak, I eventually arrive at the null point, where these effects are no longer expressed in tangible form. If I then continue, it is not the case that the effect simply disappears totally. Instead, its opposite appears and begins to be incorporated into the surrounding medium. For this reason, I always saw the opposite effects as being present in the medium, in the ointment or whatever medium was used to incorporate the homeopathic pulverized substance. This medium takes on a different configuration, just as I become a different person in the eyes of society when I make the transition from wealth to debt. Substance makes the transition to its opposite state, and then contributes this opposite state, which was formerly within it, to its surroundings. In this sense, I might say that while a substance possesses certain qualities, as I reduce it to ever smaller quantities, as I approach a certain null point, it acquires a different quality, the ability to radiate its former qualities into its surroundings, and to correspondingly stimulate the medium with which I am treating it. This stimulation can consist in directly evoking the opposite effect described here. But it is also possible that this counter-effect is evoked only by making the substance fluorescent or phosphorescent during or after exposure to light. Then we have called forth the counter-effect in the surrounding medium. These are the circumstances that must be taken into account. For from succumbing to mysticism, the issue at hand is to finally observe nature in action for once, to truly study its rhythmic processes as they apply to the qualities of substances. This is a leitmotiv for recognizing where the effects lie. If you potentize a substance, you will eventually reach a null point beyond which the opposite effects are present. But that is not all. On the route that lies beyond the null point, you can then encounter another null point that applies to these opposite effects. By passing this second point, you can achieve even higher effects that work in the direction of the initial ones, but are very different in quality. It would be a wonderful task to record the effects that result from potentization and graph them on a curve. We would discover that this graph has to be constructed in a peculiar way. We would have to begin graphing the curve, and then, when we reach the point where certain lower potencies, which are nonetheless effective, cease to have an effect, and higher potencies begin to take effect, that is, at the second null point, we would have to continue the graph at a 90-degree angle, bringing it out into three-dimensional space. These issues will be discussed further later on in these lectures. These issues, which will be discussed further later on in these lectures, are intimately connected to the human being's entire relationship to external non-human nature. Considering a substance like carbo vegetabilis strictly from the point of view of what is immediately noticeable, we will say that, taken in large doses, it induces a very specific disease picture, a specific symptom complex that, in the view of homeopathic physicians, can be counteracted with a potentization of the same substance. What is apparent to spiritual scientists who look at carbo vegetabilis? They are immediately directed toward non-human nature to investigate what is going on in the external world's more mineralized carbon, coal. And there we find that coal is essentially involved in the use of oxygen within the overall processes of the earth. The earth's coal or carbon content regulates the oxygen content of the earth's environment. We come to the direct insight that the earth is such, if understood as an organism, as indeed it must be, is subject to a breathing process, and that its coal or carbon content has to do with this process. Chemistry, of the kind that was asked for yesterday, will come about only when we see the existence of coal in connection with human or animal respiration. The interaction between the Earth's coal-forming process and the oxygen process in the Earth's atmosphere is underlaid by a force that, to the spiritual scientific way of looking at things, is revealed as the tendency to become animal. It is possible to characterize this animalizing tendency only in a somewhat surprising way. We are forced to say that something intrinsic to the external process that confronts us, the interaction between carbonization in the earth and the processes that take place around the oxygen in the earth's surroundings, calls forth beings, actual etheric beings, which, in contrast to the animal kingdom, constantly strive to escape from the earth. We understand the nature of the animal kingdom only when we see it as the earth's counter-response to this process that would de-animalize the earth. This counter-response then comes to light in the animalizing process. This is why, when we first introduce carbo vegetabilis into the human organism, we are introducing nothing less than the principle that strives to become animal. All the symptoms that appear, from belching to bloating to foul-smelling diarrhea to hemorrhoid formation, on the one hand, and burning pain of all sorts, on the other, stem from the fact that animal nature, which has been externalized by humankind in its process of becoming human, has been taken back into the individual human being. This permits us to say that if human beings are given carbo-vegetabilis in large doses, they are challenged to defend themselves against the animalizing process that is invading them. They defend themselves by bringing into play what they owe to having externalized animal nature in the course of their evolution. The fact that we have expelled animal nature from ourselves is associated with the possibility of creating new light within our organism. You may be astonished, but this is really true. We are creators of light in the upper parts of the body, in contrast to the lower parts, where the organs that allow us to resist becoming completely animal, are present so that we can acquire the ability to create light. This is one of the profound differences between between human beings and animals. Although the animal kingdom shares other higher spiritual processes with human beings, animals do not have the ability to generate sufficient light within themselves. At this point, we come to what I might call a truly painful chapter in modern natural science. A chapter that cannot be concealed from you for the simple reason that you cannot circumvent it if your intention is to understand the connection between the human being and the external non-human world. The great obstacles to an objective grasp of how substances in general and medicinal substances in particular work in the human organism are the laws of the so-called conservation of energy and of matter. These laws, posited as universal natural laws, are nothing but an absolute contradiction of the process of human development. The entire process of digestion and nutrition is not what the materialistic way of thinking sees it to be. The materialistic viewpoint sees this entire process as the taking in of substances. Let's keep carbon as our example, that were initially outside of us, after which the carbon, appropriately processed, is led further into the organism and then absorbed, so that we continually carry within ourselves small particles of what the outer world has given us. As far as this view is concerned, there is no difference between the carbon that is outside us and the carbon we carry around in our bodies. But this is not so. The human organism has the ability to totally destroy external, non-human carbon in the lower body, to eliminate this carbon from space, and use the counter effect to simply create it anew out of nothing. This is the true fact of the matter. Within the human being is a site where substances external to the human being are created, while at the same time the possibility to destroy these substances is present. Of course, this is not conceded by a modern science that cannot imagine the effects of substances other than in their smallest particles, wandering about like Ahasuerus. Footnote, this is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces. That's a quote from Esther chapter 1 verse 1, end of footnote. It knows nothing of the life, creation, and death of substances, nor about how the death and re-enlivening of substances takes place within the human organism. The re-enlivening of carbon is connected to what we have described from a different point of view as the, quote, formation of light, close quote, in the ordinary human being. This internal, light-forming process confronts the influx of external light. With regard to the upper part of the body, we are organized in such a way that outer light and inner light meet and interact. The most essential aspect of our organization rests on the fact that where these two forms of light are meant to work together, we are in a position to keep them apart rather than allowing them to merge, so that they influence each other but do not mingle. Wherever we confront the outer light, whether through our eyes or through our skin, a dividing wall is erected between the light that originates within us and the light that works in from outside. The light that works in from outside is significant only as a stimulus to the creation of internal light. Thus, in allowing the light from outside to flow in on us, we allow ourselves to be stimulated to create internal light. Now we must understand this whole process in somewhat greater depth. When we look at our internal involvement in breaking down the material aspect of carbon, we come to the human kidneys and urinary tract, and to related upper parts of the body. Thus we approach the kidney process inside the human being when we consider the activity that is associated with carbon in external non-human nature. At the same time, the path to follow in using something like carbo vegetabilis in the human being is pointed out to us. With regard to less serious illnesses, we realize that carbo vegetabilis allows us to counteract the animalizing process in the human being that leads to nausea. The symptoms characteristic of carbo vegetabilis are nausea and its extension toward the interior of the human being. The effective counter to this tendency constitutes the counteraction in the human being. That is, everything related to the functioning of the kidney system. If you manage to stimulate this kidney process when you are confronted with the symptom complex that can be artificially induced by administering large doses of carbo vegetabilis, that is, if you manage to enhance or heighten the kidney process by administering higher potencies of carbo vegetabilis, then you are working to counteract this disease process in the human being that resembles the allopathic effects of carbo vegetabilis. In studying the remedy, carbo vegetabilis, we must understand how it relates to the entire kidney process with respect to potentization. The kidney process can also have the effect that it asserts its polar opposite in relation to digestion. That is, in cases of digestive disturbances that appear as accompanying symptoms in the disease picture of carbo vegetabilis, the kidney process can assert its counter-image. The polar opposite of digestive disease in the gut, in order to normalize these symptoms. What is going on in the case of carbo vegetabilis contrasts with the formation of light. What I have now said can be summarized and understood by imagining that this is the earth, and there's a drawing, and here is the surrounding air. Above the air, however, we come to something else that we can initially describe as a sort of blanket of warmth around the earth. If we are to move upward, away from the earth, we would encounter conditions of warmth that would surprise us because of how they contrast with earthly conditions of warmth. At some distance from the earth, what is inherent in the forces of warmth plays a role similar to that of the atmosphere itself below this blanket of warmth. The farthest end of this warmth effect, which we will posit as an extra-telluric zone of warmth, is opposite to the zone of air. Here everything acts in ways that are opposite to what takes place in our atmosphere. By removing air, eliminating the existence of air, this zone emanates what comes down to us as light. It is really nonsense to believe that our earthly light comes from the sun. This is just a rather disastrous fantasy on the part of physicists and astronomers. Our earthly light comes from this upper zone. This is where light springs up. This is where it is generated. It grows there just as plants grow down here on Earth. There's a diagram. In this sense, we are justified in saying that the creation of new original light within human beings is due to the fact that their formative forces have preserved an internal capacity to do something that otherwise takes place only above. That is, they carry within themselves the source of an extra-telluric factor. Admittedly, this extratelluric factor also works on human beings from outside, just as it works on the entire plant kingdom. But something inside them also shifts human beings to this upper zone. Now let us ask what happens if we move one zone closer to the earth than the air itself. Does the counterpart of this zone bring us a bit deeper into the human being? Well, you see, when we move from the airy element toward the earth element, we arrive at the fluid or watery element. We may well assume that there is a fluid zone beneath the zone of air. This also has its counterpart out in the cosmos, even higher up than the zone of light. Once again, everything in this zone is different, the polar opposite of what is going on in the fluid zone. Something grows up there, just as light grows in the preceding zone. Chemical forces grow up there and work into the earth. There's a drawing on page 165. It is nonsense to look for the driving forces behind earthly chemical effects in the substances themselves. They are not there. They come toward the earth from this zone. In this case, too, human beings contain something similar to what is up there in the cosmos. We human beings have an internal chemicator, in quotes, if I may put it like that. We incorporate an aspect of the heavenly sphere in which chemical activities originate. What works within the human being in this way is very strongly localized in the liver. Just study the very remarkable activity the liver develops within the human organism, its suction effect with regard to the constitution of the blood, on the one hand, and on the other its regulatory function via the secretion of gall with regard to the production of blood serum. If you look at the extensive activity of the liver and study it thoroughly, what you find is nothing less than chemistry, real chemistry, because the reality of our external earthly chemistry cannot be found on earth at all. It must be seen as a mirror image of the external non-human sphere of chemistry that can also be studied in all the wondrous functions of the human liver. We can now move beyond Carbo Vegetabilis and its inner properties by combining it with alkalis such as potassium, perhaps in the form of potassium carbonate, and inducing the corresponding effects in the human organism. The effect of all alkaline substances lies deeper in the interior of the organism, in the direction of the liver processes, while all effects related to Carbo Vegetabilis tend toward the urinary tract. We will be able to perceive an absolutely clear interaction between all alkaline substances and the processes of the liver system. If we were to study the alkaline quality, we would find that it is related to the plant-forming tendency within the human being and to human externalization of the plant kingdom, just as the carbon-like quality relates to the tendency to become animal. In previous lectures, I pointed to the process of oyster shell formation as one that is important if we want to extract and separate effects within the human being from effects occurring in nature. Here, we move from the force that results from combining carbon with potassium to the result of combining it with calcium. The interaction between carbon and calcium, however, is not the only factor at work here. It is somewhat moderated by the strong phosphorus effects that are also present in oyster shell, and by yet another factor that is due to the surrounding forces of the ocean. When we observe this process of oyster shell formation, we take another step in understanding the connection between the human being and external nature. if we move downward from water formation, again see the drawing, we come to earth formation or solidification. We would not be so embarrassed to speak of earth, water, fire, and air if this terminology had not been scorned and fallen into disuse, and if it had not been assumed that those so-called ignorant people of antiquity were speaking about actual earth and air and so on. Surely among ourselves we can at least point out such things from time to time. But the formation of solid earth also has its counterpart in the cosmos. And this counterpart, you see, is the formation of life, the origin of vitalization. Actually, this counterpart is what is to be found in the life forces themselves. These, therefore, come from even farther away than the chemical forces, and are totally killed off within the solid element in external, non-human nature. I would just like to interject a related issue here, because it may be of interest to some of you. Our Earth would be subject to constant proliferation of life, to the constant development of carcinomas, if this proliferation of extra-telluric factors were not countered by the mercurial process, by the effects that mercury exerts on the earth. It is important to at least think about these issues for once. In oyster shell formation, what generally takes place in the formation of solid earth, which we can also call the formative element in the process of becoming substance, is held back at an earlier stage. Oyster shell is prevented from being completely subsumed by the earth-forming process only because it still has connections to the ocean, to water. It is held back and solidifies at an earlier stage in the earth-forming process. Although earthworms cannot do this because they have no shell, such effects still emanate from them. For this reason, it is quite valid to state that if there were no earthworms, there would be no formative forces in the earth's interior. Earthworms are significantly involved in ensuring that the earth-forming process continues. Taken as a whole, the world of the earthworms goes beyond the formation of oyster shell, but has similar connections to the entire earth. Instead of going so far as to form actual shells, it gives rise to everything that comes about in cultivated soil, and so on. You will naturally assume that if we look for the process that lies still deeper in the interior of the human being than the chemical process, which is associated with the liver, we will again have to come to different human organs. These organs are none other than the lungs, which must be considered from two different aspects with regard to the human organism. First, they are respiratory organs, but as strange as it may sound, this is the situation only on a superficial level. At the same time, they are also regulatory organs for the earth-forming process deep within the human being. If we move from the outside in, beginning with the digestive process, and moving through the processes that form the kidneys and liver, to study the process that forms the lungs in an inner sense, that is, if we disregard them as the basis of respiratory functioning, we find that they are the opposite of the activity expressed in oyster shell formation. In its lung-forming process, the human organization has incorporated a process that lies up here, above the zone of chemistry in the external universe. References the drawing again. All you need to do is study the actual symptom complex that develops in human beings under certain circumstances as a result of calcium carbonate's influence, and you will find that this has very strong connections to all of the lung's independent life processes. It is difficult, however, to separate these processes from the ones that are influenced solely by respiration. But because the lungs serve the human organization on two fronts, it is especially important to consider that they serve both external and internal functions. You must look for pulmonary degeneration in processes similar to those that appear in oyster shell formation or the like, and certainly also in the formation of snail shells, and so on. Today, in a sense, we have taken a different perspective on a topic we also approached yesterday. It was more possible to complete the circle yesterday than it will be today. But we will manage to achieve closure with regard to today's subject in the next few days. We have reached the point of being able to see kidney, liver, and lung activities as internal human processes that correspond to external activities of air, water, and solid earth. Air activity corresponds to everything that is associated with the renal system in the broadest sense, and especially to all urinary functions. Under certain circumstances, the system, of which the kidney is the part that lies deepest in the interior, can provoke shortness of breath, as can ingesting carbovegetabilis. Thus we can say that we must look to the renal system for the deeper reasons for such respiratory disturbances as shortness of breath. And we must look to the liver system for the deeper reasons for balances and imbalances related to water or the fluid element. Thirst is related to the liver system, just as the need to breathe, shortness of breath, and respiratory regulation is related to the kidney system. All thirst is related to the liver system. It would be an interesting task to study the interconnections between various human manifestations of thirst and the effects of the liver system. Similarly, the phenomenon of hunger and everything in that area are intimately related to the lungs' inner constitution and internal metabolism. In actuality, hunger, thirst, and the need to breathe are related on the tangible side to air, water, and earth. Many other things are related to their counterparts out there in the universe. Understandably enough, if we need light stimulation, because the internal factor that creates new, original light is exhausted, this light stimulation is best obtained from light itself. As we see, this is a justification for therapeutic methods that use light. It is important to consider, however, that light baths are not always light baths. In reality, light baths are a more intense exposure to the zone of chemistry that we usually have as we go about our life on Earth. Factors accompanying the chemistry that streams in from outside, along with the light, of course, are the effective principle behind most light baths. And directly behind these factors stand, as you can see from the diagram, again that picture on page 165, the life forces, which are also present as a consequence of allowing intensified light or intensified chemical action to work on a person. It is always a question of moderation and balance, but as long as overly strong effects are avoided, the effects of the chemical and life activities accompanying the light streaming in from the universe can be extremely beneficial. In conclusion, I would like to comment in passing that it will no longer surprise you that modern science does not succeed in achieving insight into the origin of life itself. Modern science limits its search to regions where, thanks to Mercury's influence, only the counter-image of life, death, is present. to find life itself, we have to look out there, in places where today's scientists do not want to go. They want to avoid having anything to do with extra-telluric realms, if at all possible. Even when scientists have been unable to avoid considering these realms, they make everything materialistic. Their hypothesis that the seeds of life are carried down to our earth from other heavenly bodies is a convenient materialistic translation of the working of life forces. Supposedly, these seeds are carried down in a materialistic way by other heavenly bodies, avoiding all the obstacles, and then appear on our earth. Some people even see meteorites as the vehicles these seeds of life drive down to earth. So you see, today people can even claim to have successfully explained matters with their materialistic theory. Just as they believe they have explained everything that is observed on a macroscopic level by relegating it to the microscopic level or to the sub-microscopic level of molecules and atomic theory, they also believe that they have explained life when they have really only relegated it to someplace else. The end of Lecture 11.